This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon, this is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Kelly Anissa. The Malayan tiger has been critically endangered for years now, yet with ecologists and tiger conservation groups sounding the alarm on their imminent extinction, are we doing enough to make tiger protection a priority? For this year's Global Tiger Day, which falls on the 29th of July annually, which happens to be today, we take a look at some of the conservation efforts being carried out to curb this issue. Joining me on the show to tell me more about that is Dr. Mark Ryan Dharmaraj. He is the Tiger Landscape Lead from WWF Malaysia. Welcome to the show, Dr. Mark.
Thank you, Kelly, for having me here.
So the Malayan tiger, which also happens to be on our coat of arms, is critically endangered. Can you help us understand more about the current status of our tigers? You know, what is the current number like?
I think to be able to understand the current status, it's good to look back at, you know, what were the numbers before. So back in the 1950s, we thought we had about 3,000 tigers. Mm. And in the late 90s, it was down to 500 or 600 tigers. And now we're now less than 200 tigers in Malaysia.
And, you know, how are tigers doing globally?
Globally, the estimation is about 3,900 tigers. It used to be 3,200, so there has been a slight increase, mainly to the success of some countries like India and Nepal that have, you know, increased their tiger numbers. And in Nepal, they've almost doubled tiger numbers.
Hmm. So can you just maybe talk a little bit about what role tigers play in our ecosystem? Because, you know, most of us think of them as predators, and maybe because of that may not see the importance of why we should have these conservation efforts.
Right. So, I mean, tigers are what we call as apex predators. So they sit on top of the food chain and they regulate herbivores, animals that eat vegetation. So like deer, wild pigs. And in a way, they also keep in check some of the other smaller carnivores like leopards and wild dogs. Mm. And so they play an important role in the food chain and in the ecosystem. One easy way to understand, I suppose, the importance of tigers or other apex predators is if you looked at what had happened in Yellowstone National Park when, you know, wolves were removed from the park, the habitat actually changed. Even the way the trajectory of rivers also were also altered as well. Mm. And when they brought back wolves, you know, the ecosystem turned back to what it was in the beginning. And so I suppose it's difficult to fathom what would happen if tigers were not in the ecosystem, because you don't see the long-term effects. It's difficult for us to understand the long-term effects. But it definitely plays a major role in, you know, I guess, keeping the ecosystem in balance. Mm. You know, where tigers are found, it's a good indicator that the ecosystem is healthy.
The recent death of Awang Besol, the tiger suffering from canine distemper, that was very saddening. So canine distemper is a disease caused by a virus which attacks domestic animals such as dogs or other wildlife, including the tiger species. Could you tell me a little more on, you know, why or how this happened to Awang Besol and how this affects the Malayan tiger conservation efforts?
Right. So when we first saw the video, I mean, there were a lot of, people were saying that it's either a captive animal or a released animal. Mm. We didn't know whether it was, you know, canine distemper. But, you know, after further tests, the Department of Wildlife National Parks actually confirmed that it was CDV, canine distemper virus. This is not a new case for tigers because, I mean, it has been documented in Russia, India and Nepal as well. But for Malaysia, it is the first case. What happens is that the virus actually attacks the central nervous system and, you know, makes the tiger become disoriented, mm-hmm. exhibit no fear towards humans. And that's why in those videos you could see the animal, you know, not behaving in its normal state in front of people. Now, CDV has been known to actually affect not just tigers, but a range of other species as well. A classic example would be it has, you know, wiped out 30% of a small population of lions in the Serengeti, in Africa. And in some ways, tigers being solitary as opposed to lions being in a pride is sort of like a safeguard to it to a certain extent, because I mean it's easier to transmit the disease when you're living in a pack. So tigers being solitary, in that sense, it reduces the likelihood from one tiger passing it to another. Mm-hmm. However, it's critical for us to understand how the disease was transmitted, so, and also containing it within that area. But I don't think we should just raise the alarm bells and start looking at this as the biggest threat, because it could be an isolated case. Mm. What's needed is more investigation into the area, and not losing guard of what are the other main threats to tigers. I think that's quite important. So we know that we've been hit by this new emerging threat, but it's important to also address the other threats, which is more pressing actually.
So these other threats, what are they?
So the biggest threat for Malayan tigers is poaching. Obviously, you've got habitat loss, fragmentation as well. When a forest is converted, the habitat becomes smaller for the tiger. When a road cuts across a forest, it fragments the forest. In a way, roads also facilitate poachers coming into areas where it was inaccessible before. So not just main roads, but even logging roads, for example. But going back to the main threat, poaching is basically is escalating within Peninsular Malaysia. And I can give you an example of the number of snares that we have found in the area that we work in Belum and Temenggo, in Perak. From 2014 to 2019, up to date, we have easily documented about 1,400 wire snares. A wire snare is basically a cable that is made into a noose, and any animal with a trigger mechanism. So any animal that steps on it will get caught. Even if humans walked, your leg can get caught. But I mean, we are able to pull and remove ourselves from that noose. But for animals, the moment they get stuck on that snare, they're going to pull tight even harder, and the noose is just going to get harder on its leg. And most of the time, the animals die with the snares attached, or they actually, like for example, bears have been known to even bite off their legs to release themselves from snares.
Yeah.
And, I guess this snaring crisis has hit Malaysia quite bad. If you looked at other countries, for example, like Vietnam, Cambodia and Laos, they no longer have tigers. And they were hit by a major snaring crisis as well. And what we're seeing now is it's sort of like a wave from north to south, whereby, these Indo-Chinese poachers are coming into the Malaysian forest to basically target tigers and other large carnivores, including bears as well. Mm. I guess they've come to understand that most of our forests it's not easy to go inside. The terrain is quite difficult. It's very dense vegetation, and they've also realized that there's not enough enforcement personnel on the ground to protect these forests. And so we are almost like sitting ducks, I suppose, to a certain extent, for these poachers that have understood how we operate in protecting our forests here. And that's a big challenge for us now, because obviously the amount of forest that we need to protect is so vast, and the enforcement personnel is so low.
Mm. And when we talk about these poachers, what exactly do they want from the? I know some of them think. I know that there is that trait for those medicinal purposes, that traditional medicine. But what. Is there any other reason why this is, this keeps continuing despite efforts to stop it?
I guess when there's a demand, there's definitely going to be this continuous search to get these animals for wildlife trade. Tiger parts are not only used in traditional Chinese medicine, But, you know, I mean, it's sort of like a symbol status. I mean, only the rich can afford tiger wine, for example. So mm-hmm. tiger bones are marinated in wine and, they're consumed.
Okay, I never knew that.
Yeah, and you know, it's not cheap. And so, you know, I mean, I suppose it's more of the affluent can afford it. And so, yeah, as long as there's demand, there's going to be this increase in poaching as well. And what we've seen, at least in the forests, is mainly is Indo-Chinese poachers are looking for, yes, tigers, leopards, bears, but they also look for something called agar wood, scented wood, basically, which they can sell for quite a lucrative amount. So, you know, whilst they're in the forest, they would, I suppose, look for, you know, both these entities. And like I said, I mean, the biggest problem we have is that we don't have enough people protecting the forest.
Mm. And, you know, I mean, you said leopards and bears are also, they are also targeted by these poachers, but they are not doing as badly as the tigers. Is it because the poachers or the demand for these tiger products are higher? Is that what it is?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's a difficult one to respond to because actually we don't know enough about our population of leopards and bears. For tigers, for example, they have stripes, and each individual tiger is different. Stripe patterns are different from another, and that makes it easier for us to monitor the number of tigers. So we use camera traps to monitor these tigers and know the number of tigers. Whereas for leopards, almost 90% of our leopards in Malaysia, they're all melanistic, so they're all black. Mm. And it's very difficult to use camera trap technology to identify those individuals. And bears also lack, you know, distinct natural markings. So it's tough to say that, you know, it's only impacting tigers. Because yeah. I think the other carnivores are also equally impacted. And snares, for example, they do not discriminate what sort of animal gets caught. Any animal that passes through the trail is going to get caught. And in that aspect, even tiger prey, so like sambar deer, barking deer and wild pig, the prey numbers will also go down depending on the number of snares that they have. So if prey numbers go down, tigers will not be able to reproduce fast enough. And that affects, I guess, the tiger population as well.
Mm.
I think it's constantly getting higher because, I mean, as the supply goes down, obviously, and demand is still there, you're bound to have the increase in the sale of such products.
Mm.
And, you know, I mean, like I said, Vietnam, Cambodia and Laos no longer has tigers. And of course, they're going to go down to other countries that have the remaining last population of tigers. And our numbers are really, really, you know, in a really crisis sort of a situation. Less than 200 tigers should sound the alarm bells for us.
Mm.
And, you know, all effort needs to be made to protect this last few that we have.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite scary, isn't it, to think that the next generation might possibly never come to know what tigers are.
Exactly. I mean, now at this state, we can still go into a forest and walk on a trail and try to find tiger tracks and feel happy that, you know, these majestic animals are still in our forest. But over the next few years, I mean, 2-3 years is quite optimistic if we don't do anything about dealing with these poachers. If it's just business as usual, we will lose our tigers very soon.
All right, so I'm speaking to Dr. Mark Ryan Damaraj. He is the Tiger Landscape Lead for WWF Malaysia. Today is Global Tiger Day. We will be right back after the break. You're listening to Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Earth Matters on the Bigger Picture and I'm Kelly Anissa. I am speaking to Dr. Mark Ryan Damaraj. He is the Tiger Landscape Lead of WWF Malaysia. Today is Global Tiger Day. So the Water, Land and Natural Resources Minister, Dr. Xavier Jayakumar, had previously spoke about the implementation of integrated patrols and enforcement with the armed forces and the Royal Malaysian Police. You know, are there any updates on that front? You know, has that initiative already begun?
I guess first and foremost, I think it's important to recognize and commend. It's highly commendable what Dr. Xavier is doing, because I mean we've got a lot of attention on tigers now,
mm.
So it's really good that someone is trying to champion tiger conservation. And as you have already mentioned, they've been trying to get at least 2,000 army personnel to help with the patrolling. They also have been in discussion with the police to help out. I mean, I would know as much as the public would know based on the newspapers and media information out there that getting the army, as what YB Dr. Xavier has mentioned, is quite a challenge at this point because it's an issue of funding. Apparently, they need about 20 million ringgit per year. And that's not just for the salaries, that's just for the allowances and the operational costs. And so it's unfortunate that, you know, we have we are in this predicament because we really needed this boots on the ground, not today, but like yesterday, you know. And if you're not going to get that soon, like I mentioned earlier, we've got only a 2 to 3 year period because many people don't realize is that the Indo-Chinese people, poachers that come in, they come in and they will set easily about, you know, 50 to 200 snares, depending on how large the groups are. And with less than 200 tigers, and tigers being habitual and territorial, you know, it's very easy to wipe out these animals over this three-year period. Mm-hmm. All you need is, you know, several incursions of these poachers, and they will start. You can start seeing local extinctions in some of the different parks and forest reserves, and once that happens, I guess the reproduction rate of tigers will not be fast enough to be able to repopulate the area. It's great that Malaysia, Peninsula Malaysia, has you know, has still contiguity in terms of the forest, so there's still connectivity which allows tigers to move up and you know, into different forested areas. But that alone is not enough. My worry is that if we don't stem this poaching crisis now, we're going to end up in what we term as an empty forest syndrome. Mm. So you'd have the habitat, it'd be connected and be protected, but you know, at the end of the day, there's no animals inside. And that's what's happened in, like I mentioned, in Vietnam, Cambodia and Laos. It wasn't just tigers, but a lot of other carnivore species were also wiped out.
Right. So I'm sure that you get this question a lot, but because our tigers are disappearing so rapidly and under so much threat from, you know, poachers, could we not, you know, I suppose, take the remaining tigers and perhaps care for them in a conservation facility or in just a generally controlled area in which they can be monitored? Because, you know, if the situation is as dire as it is, would that be a feasible way to approach the overall issue now?
I think that's the most common common question that we get posed with. I mean, for the general public, it may seem you know, like it's like a no-brainer to get tigers to be bred in a captive environment and then release them back in the wild. I guess one has to understand the tiger ecology to be able to respond to that, because in the wild, the cubs live with the mother for 2 to 2.5 years, mm-hmm. right? And within that period is when they actually learn how to hunt and fend for themselves. Now, if you're going to try to replicate that sort of training in a captive environment, it's extremely difficult. For one, and it's also very costly. And, you know, you've got to minimize the human contact with such animals, and it's very difficult. And there are not many successful cases out there. Mm. And so although tigers breed very fast, they have about, you know, 103 days gestation period. So very, very fast they can breed. But, you know, it's not as simple as just breeding them and releasing them back in the wild. I mean, if that was the case, then it would have been done in other countries as well. Mm. Nevertheless, I mean, I think it's very important for us to keep a good genetic pool. So I think zoos can play a role in that sense, to be able to have a reservoir of gene pools for the Malayan tiger. Now, I suppose the Department of Wildlife National Parks also has animals in captivity. And, you know, although they can try to look at such captive breeding facilities for rehabilitation and to be released back in the wild, I just need to stress that, I mean, at this point, the priority should be made to protect the remaining tigers in the wild. It's a resource issue at this point. Like 20 million to get the army is something that we're lacking, and I would rather get the money to have boots on the ground than to invest on a lot of money on captive breeding centers and trying to rehabilitate or to try to see if you can release them into the wild, because that's going to be very costly and it's going to be time consuming. And we have the chance now, we have the opportunity now to save tigers in the wild, and that's what we should be doing.
And, I mean, do you think we've done enough to make tiger protection a priority here?
So, obviously with the tiger numbers going down, that has to be a yes to that answer as to, we're definitely not doing enough. It's a enforcement personnel issue to a certain extent, but it's also an issue of making tigers a national priority or looking at poaching as a major threat to the security of the country. I just draw back to the examples in India and Nepal. Now, in these countries, what they've done is they've something what they call as a Wildlife Crime Coordination Bureau, a committee, or a unit. And they've got, army, police, all involved in trying to streamline their efforts to try to reduce poaching and wildlife trade. Mm. So Nepal is a very good example, and in India as well. So we need something like that. And, having something like an environmental crime unit, that as at least, I guess, one arm looking at the wildlife trade and poaching would be really useful. The police are really great at intelligence gathering. We can do as much as possible to catch the poachers on the ground, but at the end of the day, it is the middlemen and how these animals are being transported across, the border of our country into Indo-Chinese countries and China. It's important to understand that link and to try to break that link. And only unless we've got that sort of, intelligence gathering and I suppose on the ground efforts to reduce the poaching incidences, it's going to be a tough battle. And unfortunately, like I mentioned, we don't have enough people as the first line of defense. It's not there. Royal Bloom State Park, for example, is almost twice the size of Singapore, but they have about 30 rangers now. And that's just not enough to cover the amount of forest that they need to protect. And that's why gathering or at least trying to get help from the police and the army is critical at this juncture. Obviously, we're not going to be able to increase the number of personnel drastically very fast. I mean, it's money, right? So at the end of the day, we'd have to rely on the political will that will enable some of these other agencies, enforcement agencies, to help out. I think that's the way to go, at least in the short term, till we figure out what else we can do for the long term for tigers.
And you mentioned Nepal is a good example when it comes to tiger protection efforts. Just out of curiosity, how does Malaysia compare to other countries regionally or even globally in terms of our declining tiger numbers and our conservation efforts? How does it look like? Are we doing well? Are we doing really bad?
We're doing extremely bad, actually. if you look at India is almost close to 60-70% of the world's population of tigers. Nepal has bounced back over the last 10 years to about 200 over tigers. If you are just looking at tiger numbers, our tiger numbers will always be much lower compared to countries like India because of the ecological, determinants. So we have less large prey, we have less diversity of prey for tigers here. And the density of this prey is actually low compared to what you find in India. So obviously our tiger densities will be, many folds lower to what we have in India. But that doesn't mean that we cannot you know, I guess, maintain that sort of density. So in India, you would have, you know, easily about 18 tigers for every 100 square kilometers. Mm. In Malaysia, you would normally never exceed 2 to 3 tigers for every 100 square kilometers. So it's a huge difference there. And because we are tropical rainforests, and in India, you've got grasslands, you've got deciduous forests, you've got tropical forests, it's an intermixed area, allowing for, you know, tigers to thrive very well in these areas. Tropical rainforests will allow tigers to thrive, but, you know, to a certain extent. And that extent is, you know, between 2 to 3 tigers for every 100 square kilometers. Having said that, in terms of conservation measures, in India, in some of the places, they've got rangers following tigers almost every day. They've got every 10 square kilometer covered by, you know, 2 or 3 rangers. Mm. If you compare that to us, we have definitely less than 1 ranger for every 100 square kilometers, not even 10 square kilometers. And so, obviously, the protection aspect needs to be beefed up. But in terms of the habitat, what's really good about Peninsular Malaysia is that we still have forests, and we still have the backbone of the forest, the Banjaran Titiwangsa range, or the main range. Malaysia has got great plans. I just want to draw back to something called the Central Forest Pine Master Plan. It's a spatial blueprint to identify where forest needs to be connected, to be protected. And essentially, the whole Central Forest Pine is the habitat of the tigers. Mm. And it's a federal document. Now, as we all know, you know, at the end of the day, land is a state matter. And so it's really up to the states to be able to decide whether they will be able to subscribe to what has been proposed in the Central Forest Pine Master Plan. But, you know, I mean, I guess states also need revenue. So to that aspect, it's a challenge trying to maintain forest cover, natural forest cover. There's no point converting a forest into a timber plantation and then expect tigers to live in that area. You just lose those natural qualities and habitat qualities for tigers to thrive or their prey. So Malaysia is doing well in that sense in terms of, you know, coming up with great plans. But the implementation of such plans, you know, that's a different story. In India, you've got, you know, I guess, forests that are, I guess, they're quite fragmented, actually. But, you know, they have an age over us in terms of the natural capacity of the environment to be able to support many more tigers and many more prey species. The other thing is, I suppose, that stands out is India and Nepal have the highest political will to support tiger conservation. And I think this is where we need to be able to emulate countries such as India and Nepal to move towards trying to have a chance to save our tigers. And that is something that we wanna try to get Malaysians to rally with us this Global Tiger Day.
Right. And I mean, just before we go into that, Dr. Xavier Jayakumar said it could take about 20 million ringgit to roll out that initiative, to have the armed forces and the Royal Malaysian Police help with that. But is that a number that is that an amount that other countries have also spent on the conservation efforts, or is there a way for us to do better in that sense? Is there a way for us to cut down and still have that same amount of efforts for the tigers?
So I think if you look at India, for example, they've got a system whereby the federal government allocates a huge portion of money for tiger reserves. And the states are also needed to match those amounts, but to a lower level. Now, one of the things that drives, the maintenance of some of these parks is that there's a lot of tourism. So ecotourism is big in India. And in fact, if you want to look at tigers, well, India is probably one of the best places to go and, you know, take a jeep and you'll probably be able to spot a tiger. Mm. And that model seems to be working there.
The tourism model.
The ecotourism model. But, you know, I mean, for us, it's not easy to see a tiger in the tropical rainforest. It's not as easy as what you will find in India or even in Nepal. That doesn't mean that, you know, we shouldn't look at a different angle to trying to protect the forest and trying to protect tigers. I mean, the forest gives us a lot of ecosystem services. Ecosystem services that we don't sometimes think about. It's an important watershed. It's able to, you know, contain not just tigers, but a whole range of biodiversity. It's important for, you know, reducing erosion. And all of these important ecosystem services, water is the biggest, I would say. We really need to move away from the short-term benefits of trying to convert forests and look into the long-term benefits of it. Looking at the natural capital that we'll be able to gain if we preserve this forest. And so, you know, I suppose I guess one clear example that I can give is that federal allocations, for example, for the state, normally it's based on the number of people or population there is in the state or the length of roads. Now, if you looked at a different model of trying to understand how much of natural forests they would have in a state, and use that as a criteria to also afford some funds for the state, that will be able to, I guess, motivate states to be able to protect more forests. So that's one way that we can think of. But going back to your question of this comparison of protection
of expenditure, I mean, is there a way, or, you know, just looking at some of the other initiatives that other countries have done, is there a way for us to do it with less money? I mean, for us to do it, because we have such a short amount of time and we have no idea when that funding may come in to roll out these initiatives.
Exactly. So, in that sense, I think because time is, we're really on a race against time. The critical thing now is to figure out how we can use the existing enforcement personnel. And so what the Ministry of Water and Land and Natural Resources are doing is really great. But we really need to get them on board now. You know, so the 20 million that we're looking at, if we can't get 20 million in a short time frame, what's the next best thing that we can do? If you ask people who are doing the anti-poaching work, they would say, if you can't get 2,000 people, get special tactical teams in place. So from 2,000, get to, you know, a few hundred, deploy these tactical teams, and I suppose act on the information that the NGOs and the communities are giving. That's one way of going about it. You know, if you can't get 20 million now, that is something that we really need to move forward with. So police, for example, the police have something what they call as police gara arm. Special General Operations Armed Force, I think. This unit is actually specialized in the forest. And if we are able to harness their strengths and, you know, get their support, I think we'll be closer to getting to reducing these poaching incidences in the forest. Mm. But ultimately, it boils down to us making tigers a national priority. Because if you make tigers a national priority, like what India and Nepal does, they have afforded enough resources, they've afforded enough funding, they've looked at, you know, management decisions, policy decisions that favor tiger conservation as well as land management. So if you have that sort of political will at the highest level, I don't see why the Ministry of Finance, the Ministry of Defence, and the Home Ministry, for example, can't get together and sort it out. If they want to, they can. And I suppose if the directive is given to move towards that aspect as well.
And I mean, that's on the administration, but, you know, what can communities, what can the people or even corporations do to help further this agenda to protect our tigers? You know, how can we, for example, with corporations, how can they move beyond that PR-centric initiative to help actually make a difference in this?
Right. So maybe I'll just give an example of what we've been doing in Belum and Temenggor Forest Complex. Like I mentioned, I mean, the Para Sepas Corporation does not have enough rangers. So what WWF Malaysia does is that we hire the indigenous people that live in and around the area to help patrol the forest. Now, last Global Tiger Day, we basically announced that we have 50% less tigers in this area. And we just simply couldn't wait for the enforcement personnel to be put in place. And what we did was we hired easily about 50 orang aslis, and they are sweeping the forest and removing snares in this area. And that has actually helped reduce the snare encounter rates in the forest. So communities play a huge role in terms of being the eyes and the ears for the authorities. And it's unfortunately not a, you know, it's not cheap. It's really a costly endeavor. It costs easily about 1 million ringgit just to maintain these 50 orang asli community teams to patrol the forest. In terms of corporate, so I guess one example with WF Malaysia is that we have been in a 4-year partnership with Maybank Foundation, and they've been helping us with our target conservation program in terms of the funds. So they've contributed for about 5.2 million for over 4-year period, and that has allowed us to, you know, continue our work on the ground. And so obviously, I mean, this is basically a call for corporates to emulate you know, what Maybank Foundation has done. And if we are able to get corporates together, corporates for conservation, for tiger conservation, for example, gather these corporates to be able to not only just channel funds, but I suppose, you know, raise the need for people to be aware and to be connected to tigers and wildlife in Malaysia. So I think that's a role that corporates really need to step up, especially in this dire situation of our tiger numbers going down to less than 200.
And, you know, as you said, today is Global Tiger Day. Just as a refresher, how did this day come about? And, you know, what is the end goal? What is it supposed to achieve?
Right. So Global Tiger Day was initiated back in 2010 at St. Petersburg in Russia.
I see.
So there was a Global Tiger Summit that was held there, and 13 Tiger Range countries came together in that platform to basically commit to trying to double the number of tigers by the next year of the tiger, which is 2022. Mm. Now, so Global Tiger Day was formed on that day. Although that summit actually took place in November, we celebrate Global Tiger Day on July 29th. Mm. Yeah, I mean, even prior to that summit, Malaysia had actually already committed to double the number of tigers, you know, a few years prior to that. Unfortunately, from 500 tigers, in our action plan, we wanted to move towards 1,000 tigers. We're now down to less than 200, unfortunately. But so, some countries have managed to, you know, double, like Nepal. And so they're moving they're following the tiger recovery plan that was set up there, you know, very well in that sense. So Global Tiger Day is pretty much a platform for people to take the opportunity to understand the situation of tigers in their respective countries and in the world, and to figure out how they can contribute towards saving tigers and these big cats.
And what is the focus for this year's Global Tiger Day?
So we just recently had a Malayan Tiger Run in IOI City Mall, Putrajaya. And the main purpose of that run was to get Malaysians to rally for tigers. And we have basically launched what we're calling a Malayan Tiger Pledge. Mm. A pledge to get, to offer Malaysians a chance to rally for tigers, to be able to ask our government to make tigers a national priority. This is just based on, you know, like I mentioned, the models in India and Nepal. I'll start off with India. I mean, if Indira Gandhi back in the late 70s did not establish Project Tiger, I don't think tigers would do very well now in India. Similarly, in Nepal, you know, in 2010, when the Prime Minister went to the St. Petersburg summit, he made sure when he came back that he formed something called a National Tiger Conservation Committee, and he chaired that committee. And over a 10-year period, they've managed to double the number of tigers. So I think that's there's two examples that can't be any more clearer than we need it to be. And so this is what we're trying to emulate. And we are calling for Malaysians and the general public to rally with us to ask for, you know, such a National Tiger Conservation Committee to be formed, and to be chaired by the highest political will within the country.
And how can they do that? Is there a social media page? Is there a campaign that they can participate in to help with that awareness?
Yes, so we have online page at wwf.org.my/tigerpledge. So you can sign up on that page and basically support the call that we're making. And we hope that, you know, it's our hope that by next Global Tiger Day, we should be able to garner as much supporters and hand over this this call for action to the Prime Minister.
So we are reaching the end of our show now. Do you have a final message for us?
I think I would just like to ask for Malaysians to rally with us to support tiger conservation. And with the Tiger Pledge, the Malayan Tiger Pledge, I hope you'll be able to get as many supporters to garner the political will that we need within the country. I think it's very, very important. And in any aspect, in every aspect that you think that you'll be able to contribute, please do so.
Thank you for joining me on the show today. I was speaking to Dr. Mark Ryan Damaraj. He is the Tiger Landscape Lead from WWF Malaysia. Today is Global Tiger Day. If you've missed any part of this interview or any Earth Matters segment, you can download the podcast on the BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and also on Spotify. You've been listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.